kindly steed the earth. He says it in Chaucerian language, but that's what he says. Now, Chaucer is no fool. Chaucer knows a lot about nature. He actually was the first person to write a scientific treatise in English. He wrote a little book on how to use the astrolabe, called The Art of Dialing, which is considered to be the first scientific treatise in English, for his son Lewis. Before you smile indulgently at this simple idea, just pause for a moment and ask, would Chaucer, if he came to this room, be impressed by our law of nature? Not at all. He would say, but what do you mean by law of nature? Do you mean you put it in prison if it doesn't do it? See, the whole idea of a law of nature is equally well a kind of metaphor. The metaphor of love is a metaphor, you know, Chaucer would say, well, because he doesn't exactly do it for that. Can be looked upon as the scientific equivalent of Martin Luther. You see, within the Catholic Church, there was a movement to take significance away from the priests and to the individual worshipper. You know, that's what it was all about. Galileo represents an attempt to do science this way, to instead of saying the way we look at nature is going to be given to us by how the Church says we should think about it, we want to be able to look at nature itself. Nature, says Galileo, is the word of God out there for us to investigate. And with intelligence and diligence, we can find out the word of God, not just by looking at the Bible, but by looking at the works of God, nature lying out there. That was Galileo's approach to it. The difficulty is, of course, as you would imagine, that different people see different things when they look at nature. So how do you get over this fact when you want to say things that are somehow true and somehow other, not everybody going out and saying different things? And that's where you turn to mathematics. The bane of a lot of students' lives, a lot of throughout my career as a science teacher, I've seen so many cases of people who'd like to be scientists and who find that they say they cannot do mathematics. I'm sure you've met such people. Mathematics, of course, is only a tool, and in science, at least, it has its, as a discipline, it's separate, but in science, mathematics is a tool, and it's very sad that it should get in the way, but why should mathematics be so important? Well, that really goes back, if my slides are correct. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm running a little shade ahead. Let me just indicate why there should be this movement for individuality and why should we be moving towards a mechanical universe. Well, this photograph I took in Cambridge, in England, only a mile or two away from the modern Institute of Theoretical Astronomy, it is not in fact a windmill, although it looks like it, it's a wind pump. This part of England is very low-lying. The fenland, as it's called, so they have to pump the water away. This is several hundred years old, this windmill, and it's put on simply as a symbol of the fact that one of the reasons, and there's a whole complex of reasons, one of the reasons that we began to move towards a mechanical picture of nature was simply that, as a result of wars and plagues, there was a great shortage of agricultural laborers. In addition to which, the growth of towns as a result of the development of merchants' operations required that agriculture be more efficient. And so gradually, mechanical devices in agriculture became vital. And so the artisan, the person who's used to making machines, became an important part of society. in classical Greece, he'd always been the class of slaves, which is why the philosophers like Aristotle, you'd think if you read them that nothing mechanical was ever done in Greece, but we now know that wasn't true. But it is that the people who made machines in classical Greece were lowly people that no self-respecting philosopher would have written about. Nevertheless, here in Chartres, which was built in 1200, we see among all of the Chartres itself was designed on the old medieval worldview. It is full of harmonies in its geometry, full of geometrical relationships of a harmonious nature. But in addition, to build the great Gothic arches, you need these things, which are called flying buttresses. And they're not just ornament. If you took them away, the building would fall down. The people who built Chartres were not only activated by this great medieval view of the harmonious world, but they knew an awful lot about how materials behaved. And it's not surprising, one can see it happening, that as artisans become more important, so a view of the world that's more closely related to the artisans' handling of things and making machines is like to become predominant. And Galileo himself, in the introduction to his famous dialogue, says, praises the artisan. So we again have here a social change, the artisan becoming socially important, that gradually leads to a change in the way we look at nature. And this is illustrated very clearly. Here I'm talking to the converted, I know, but let's just have a little sequence that reminds us of what is happening throughout these centuries. This is a painting, or whatever, going back to about the year 1000. There you see the angels and the stars and hell and the earth and so on. But it's obvious that the relation between the angels and the stars and everything is symbolic. It's a symbolic relationship. It's the symbolism that matters. I don't mean that the person who painted that was conscious of abstracting symbolism. The symbolism was what the reality was, the actual geometrical relationships in terms of how far you had to walk to get to a star was a pretty abstract kind of a thing. The reality was the symbolism. By about the beginning of the 14th century, here this is a famous painting by Giotto, you see the beginnings of what you can think of as trying to represent actual objects, in this case people, in a three-dimensional way. It hasn't got too far yet, but it's clearly there. Within just over 100 years of Giotto, you find not only have we got three-dimensional representations, you've got perspective, which is remarkably fierce. This is a small portion of the Annunciation of Crivelli, by Crivelli. In that period, you see in the art, the geometrization of perception. And geometry, you remember, has to do with locality. Geometry represents the relationship between things in specific localities. Without imagining that a place can be given a label, you couldn't have geometry. And so, this again is an artistic representation of the change that's taking place over these 100 or 200 years. Moving towards an idea that the individual is important rather than the overall pattern. That's the symptom. That's an example of that happening. You see it most clearly in, for example, Christopher Columbus. I'm sorry about the weakness of this, but this is a reconstruction of the Santa Maria and the Pinta lying in harbor somewhere, Cuba or somewhere. Remember that Christopher Columbus discovered the New World in the end of the 15th century. I have in the Reader's Digest Great World Atlas, not the most authoritative work on geography, is this map called the Known World in 1490. Do you notice how all of this continent is in gloom and darkness? One wonders what Montezuma thought of being undiscovered. There's a very curious mentality that talks about that part of the world being known. and the rest being unknown. Known to whom? You see, the whole idea of going out and discovering things didn't really come into the world, in the quote, modern world, until about the time of Columbus. Of course, people were traveling before, and I'm not even talking about the Vikings going to Newfoundland and so on. People had trade routes all over the world linking up with each other. But nobody thought of going out and discovering places. That requires a change in the perception. If, after all, you think that everything in nature is related to everything else through universal harmonies, going somewhere else isn't any big deal. Because going somewhere else is going to be in all its essence exactly like where you left. In order to make any sense of going out and discovering something, you have to perceive each locality as having a sort of existence of its own, and then you go somewhere else and you find something that is different. Now, of course, people traveled before. Marco Polo in the 13th century had gone to the east of China. It isn't something that happens overnight, but in the period between about the year 1200 and about the year 1550 or thereabouts, this significant change had taken place. From seeing the world as a great unity held together by harmony to seeing it as individual things, being in individual places, and in order to know how things work, you've got to know how one thing interacts with another. In other words, we've switched from the disseminated field theory view of nature to the atomic localized view yet once more. The change was symbolized by Nicholas Copernicus, here he is, a churchman, as a matter of fact, who got involved with altering the calendar and things like that sort. But he was dissatisfied, not for practical reasons, but for intellectual reasons that I won't go into with you today, dissatisfied with the old world picture of Aristotle and how it had been used. Not, I hasten to add, and again, this is so often wrongly said in books on the history of science, not because it didn't work. The old theory, as worked on by the Arabs, actually was much better at predicting where the planets were going to be than the theory of Copernicus. It was a philosophical problem, not a practical one. But be that as it may, Copernicus said, you know, you get a much simpler representation of the motion of the planets if you assume not that the Earth is the center, but that the Sun is, that the apparent rotation of the sky is the rotation of the Earth, and the Earth goes around the Sun, and the other planets do, and so on, and the stars are fixed. This is how, a little while after Copernicus, the theory appeared in an English book in 1576. There is the Sun at the center, the planets Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn going round the Sun, the Moon going around the Earth, and the stars forming a fixed background. What you have done is changed your definition of being fixed from the Earth, where Aristotle had it. To Aristotle, motion meant motion relative to the Earth. You've changed it now. Motion now means relative to the stars. On the face of it, a not very profound technical change. But it has the most disastrous consequences for the old worldview. For example, on this basis, it wasn't long before people began to suspect that the stars were simply suns a long way away. And if they were suns, presumably they had planets. Pick up any book on astronomy at the beginning of the 18th century, it's assumed without question that all stars have inhabited planets. We have very grave doubts about that proposition now, but it was taken for granted. And then, of course, you have a problem, because the whole Christian religion depends upon the fact that God became incarnate in Jesus Christ on the earth. So what do you do about it? Do you have a separate Christ for every planet, around every star? Somebody got burnt at the stake for proposing that. His name was Giordano Bruno. Burnt at the stake in about the year 1600. Well, the details are unimportant. important to the argument now. It's very clear, I think, that shifting from the Earth as the center to the background stars as the standard of rest has profound significance for the whole philosophy of the medieval worldview. And that's what the argument with Galileo was really about. It was an argument about what was it was wise to take as your framework for understanding nature. And remember, it isn't a question of fact, it is a question of perspective. And why did mathematics get involved in it? Well, it really has to do with this guy. His name is Plato, Platon, as he should be called, which itself was a nickname. And he lived, Aristotle was his graduate student, so Plato was around 400 BC. And Plato conceived of mathematics as being the example of the timeless truth. Let us take, for example, a triangle that I might draw on the blackboard. Now, that triangle that I draw on the blackboard is never perfect. The lines are never quite straight, they don't quite meet at the corners. The lines are, in any case, finite thickness. The laws of geometry, such as that the angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees, wouldn't apply exactly to the thing I draw on the board, but they apply exactly to an ideal triangle. And it shouldn't be a matter of opinion, so it was thought. Mathematics, which deals with abstract things abstracted from the world of nature, is not a matter of opinion. So if you want to arrive at truths about nature, you abstract, you experiment, in order to isolate those aspects that correspond to this absolutely unchanging, absolutely true system of mathematics. But an experiment is specifically the manipulation of nature to behave in a way kindly to your mathematics. And that's where force comes into science. Scientists do not, I repeat, do not, contrary to the popular view, go and look at nature as it is. They tried to do that for quite a while in the 16th century. They thought that if you go out and look at nature and acquire lots of isolated facts, that your intelligence will see order in it. It never worked that way. The Royal Society was formed to follow these so-called Baconian principles, and the only result was that within half a generation, it had become broke. It had no money. It had spent all its money publishing books on fishes. If you look at the early transactions of the Royal Society, you'll find that cheek by jowl, you get a paper on a monstrous cow in Sussex with two heads, on how to measure the specific gravity of the hairs on the legs of cheese mites and the internal structure of the earth. And out of all of this mixture of random piece of information, absolutely nothing happened. That isn't the way to do science, and it's not the way that science has ever worked. The way that science works is that you start off with an idea and you say, if I apply that idea as a filter to nature, how fine does nature look? How simple when I look through it. Another reason for the mechanical view of the world becoming prominent was the development of clocks. Now, clocks originally were not to tell time, they were to tell you the positions of the sun, moon, and planets. Here's a famous clock in the cathedral at Prague. It's been much renovated, but it is in spirit what it was originally. You can see all the planets and the sun and moon up there. And indeed, in the medieval worldview, time wasn't something that things moved in. Time was created by the motions of things. So that time was created by the motion of Saturn, the slowest moving planet. And you're all familiar with Saturn. He's the old guy who comes around with a scythe on the 31st of December every year, Old Father Time. It was thought that time was created by the motions of things, not the converse. So the mechanical view of nature, if you can make a machine that will represent how the sun, moon, and planets move, maybe that's really what they are. And the person who really was to lead the, was to finally give us the synthesis that was to last for nearly 300 years, Isaac Newton. Here he is in his old age. That's a contemporary portrait. I suppose he looked like that. He looks like an embittered old man. He probably was. I like to think of him like this, which is the statue to Newton in Trinity College, Cambridge, which is where he spent most of his life. The young man, the world is his oyster, holding in his hand a prism because he was going to investigate light and so on. I love to think of him like that. The trouble is that that's not a contemporary sculpture. And so we don't know if he ever looked like that, but it's nice to think he did. Now, I want you to understand that the scientists of the 17th century, like Newton, were very far from being the mechanically minded people you tend to think of now, although Newton, as a kid, used to make toy windmills and things. Newton spent most of his time on alchemy, which is a sort of chemistry associated with astrology. The great scientists of this period were almost all of them interested in astrology. Here's Johannes Kepler, around about 1600, who first formulated the laws of planetary motion, and he formulated them in the form of music. Did I put this in here or not? No, I didn't. All right, well, we'll get to that later, just at the end. I'm going to finish by about 1:30, I think. Kepler saw the whole world in the old harmonious viewpoint. He represented the behavior of He represented the planetary system in the form of music. I'll come to that later on. And what Newton did was, he said, well, there's all this problem about how we should refer motions. I'm going to cut the Gordian knot. I'm going to say by definition that there's a thing called absolute space, which is everywhere entirely featureless, but which is everywhere, which means that in principle, at every point in space, you could stick a little label saying where you were. Now, unfortunately, nature doesn't give us a graph paper with all the coordinates written down. So you have to take a surrogate for this universal graph paper. And says Newton, the best surrogate are the fixed stars. Notice how you've switched your frame of reference from the Earth to the stars, the fixed stars. They won't be exact. Even Newton knew, because his colleague Halley, of comet fame, had actually shown that the stars had moved in the 1,000-odd years since the old classical Greek catalogues. But, says Newton, it's a good approximation. Take the stars as fixed, then you can talk about how things move, then you can distinguish the Earth going around the Sun from the Sun going around the Earth. Now that's all right until you get people like myself. I spent most of my professional career worrying about how the stars moved. So if the stars are moving, they can't be a standard of rest. What standard of rest is there? We still don't know that answer. So I don't want you to think these problems are old-fashioned ones. I spend a lot of my professional time looking at the question of what should be our standard of rest. Now we know that the stars are all moving around all the time, speeds of hundreds of kilometers a second. And the answer is not clear. But Newton said, it's good enough for a first approximation. It serves as well as maybe, let's take the stars. And what about time? Time, said Newton, went on regularly, regardless of anything else. He didn't explain what time going irregularly would have meant. And if you stop to think about it, it's a funny idea. But he said time goes on regularly and smoothly, absolute time, and at a rate unaffected by what happens. How do I measure that? Well, says Newton, you know, they say you can't do it exactly because nature doesn't provide us with a clock everywhere. But we've got the rotation of the Earth. That's pretty good. So, in practice, motions of things became measured relative to the stars and timed relative to the rotation of the Earth. That was what time was. Until around 1925, when a gentleman of the name of Short, S-H-O-R-T-T, invented a very accurate pendulum clock. And it was so accurate that all the observatories in the world wanted this pendulum clock to time the passage of stars across their telescopes, because astronomers classically spent a lot of time keeping an eye on time. After all, how do you know that the clock on the wall is correct, or how do you know what its error is? Because somewhere or other there are still astronomers who are looking at the way the stars appear to move across their telescopes. Well, they sent those pendulum clocks around to all the observatories. After a year or two, a very surprising result came out. Pendulum clocks suddenly seemed to start going fast or slow. But what was odder is that all over the world, they'd all start going fast simultaneously. Or suddenly, all over the world, the pendulum clocks would start going slowly. It looked like extrasensoryception among pendulum clocks. Well, that wasn't a solution that was very favorable to scientists. What's the other one? That the Earth is rotating irregularly. And that's the thing that we adopt now. We don't talk about pendulum clocks or later on quartz clocks or atomic clocks as changing their rates. We talk about the Earth as changing its rate of rotation. But to do that, we had to change the definition of time. I had to change the legal definition. And all of this was an attempt to maintain Newton's idea that everywhere in space there was, in principle, a little tag that said where you were, and everywhere, in principle, a clock that said what the time was. And although nature didn't actually provide these in a tangible form, logically, you could deduce an absolute space and time. Well, I won't tell you, and I haven't got time to tell you how the problems arose at the end of the last century in this, until Einstein came along and said, look, all of this absolute space and time is entirely a hypothesis. Supposing that I see a star exploding, we call them supernovae, supposing I see a star exploding on Christmas Day of 1986, when did it happen? Well, I don't say that it happened on Christmas Day 1986, because the star's a long way away and lights had to travel from it to me. What would be the reasonable way? Oh, you say, if I know how far away it is, I will subtract the time it takes light to travel. So if this object were 10 light years away, light year being the distance light travels in a year, I observe it on Christmas Day 1986, it must have happened on Christmas Day 1976. In other words, distance becomes the time it takes light to travel. Well, said Einstein, that's in fact what you do. Well, it isn't quite what you do, but it's nearer to what you do than using a meter stick to measure the distance to a star. So the whole theory of relativity, at least the special theory, is investigating the consequences of defining distance by the time it takes light to travel. And until 3 years ago, you could still ask whether the special theory of relativity was true, but you can't any longer. Why not? Because now that is the legal definition of distance. Distance is now defined by the international courts through the time it takes light to travel. So the theory of relativity has now become legally true by definition. Of course, it doesn't affect anything you observe, it only affects how you're allowed to describe it. Whereas before, if you'd found anomalies, you might have described it as the speed of light changing. You can't have the speed of light changing now, because distance is defined by the time it takes light to travel. So you now would describe your results in terms of changes in the size of the apparatus. Notice that. Nothing that we do can change an actual experience, but it changes the way we describe it. And that's, in fact, what happens to all scientific theories. They become tautologies, that's the technical term. In other words, things that can't be wrong because of their definition. This happened to Newton. Newton said that a body moves in a straight line with a constant speed unless acted on by a force. Well, what happens if I find something moving in a curve? Well, initially, for example, you might imagine a force as being hit on the chin, then back goes my head, so you can tell with the motion of my head that I've been hit by somebody's fist. Well, that's all right as long as you can see where the forces are. And when Newton put forward his theory, it looked like a statement about nature. On the one hand, there were the forces, somebody hitting you. On the other hand, there was the motion of your chin. But then people found disquieting situations where things were moving in curves without anything obviously giving the force. Do you throw out Newton? Not at all. You simply define a new force. Call it electricity or something. So after about 100 years after Newton, you no longer were able to disprove Newton's laws of motion. Every time you found an accelerated motion, you defined another force. The thing had become a definition. And that, by the way, is the fate of all scientific theories. They defend themselves against apparent anomalies by redefining things until ultimately they finish up as being the word tautology you may not be familiar with, something that is a matter of definition. It is often said by some philosophers of science that scientific theories get overthrown by adverse examples, anomalies. That is quite untrue. I know of no case where a substantial scientific theory was overthrown because there appeared to be an experiment that conflicted with it. What you do in the case like that is redefine the terms of the theory until so it accommodates it. What happens is that after you've been going a long while, your theory begins to get so convoluted, what I call the Baroque period of a scientific theory, that it's time to step back and look again at the way of looking at the world to see if you can't think of another way that accommodates things much simpler. And that, for example, is the merit of the theory of relativity. It's difficult to argue that you can prove that in some way it's correct and Newton wrong. It just turns out to be a simpler way of looking at nature. Sort of aesthetic judgment, almost, in the way that you might judge the merit of an artistic work. The other nail in the coffin of the old mechanical worldview came with the study of the atom, where we discovered that the disseminated and local properties of nature couldn't, in fact, be separated. You see, in everyday life, we can make a fair separation. Even with planets, we tend to think of the Earth as here, and Jupiter as somewhere out there, and Venus as somewhere out there. Strictly, when you think of Newton's gravity, for example, the gravity of the Earth stretches out to infinity. No matter where you are in the universe, however small it may be, the Earth has a little gravitational pull. So it's a convention that we say the Earth is here and not everywhere. It's because we have said the local properties of planets are more significant than the disseminated properties. Things like a law of gravity are precisely what we invent to accommodate the fact that things are not independent. It's exactly what a law of gravity or any other law of the same kind is. But when we started looking inside the atom, we found that separation couldn't be made. That inside the atom, for example, you can talk about electrons as particles. You can actually see electrons hitting a luminous screen like your television set. You can see little flashes, just like little bullets hitting the screen, and yet the pattern that they hit the screen on is characteristic of a wave motion. And you cannot separate them. So if you try to describe what happens between your observations as though it was the behavior of individual isolated objects moving around, it simply doesn't work. And so since 1930, we have known that the world is not in its ultimate constituent mechanical. We discover, for example, this is almost a kind of pornography. I'm titillating your imagination with these things without going to tell you the details about it. But I think I should just do that to indicate how very severe was the revolution of quantum theory. We can no longer talk about individual things. I can calculate, for example, how heat is transmitted down a poker when I stick it in the fire, and how long does it take for the end of the poker to get hot. And I can talk about little electrons traveling through the crystal structure of the poker. But in order to get the right answer, I make a very curious discovery. I discover that while I can talk about there being, for example, 10 electrons in a box, in principle. I cannot talk about where they are. They are not individual things. I cannot give them names. Let me see if I can give an example. Let me take half a dozen table tennis balls. Now, those half a dozen table tennis balls all look exactly the same. Nevertheless, there's nothing to stop me writing on each one a name, calling that one Harry and that one Mary and that one George. I don't conflict with any law of nature. Table tennis balls don't come that way, but I can take a pen and do it. When you get to the very small, you find that it is impossible, in principle, to name things. You can say there are 10 electrons, but you cannot name them. They're much more like waves in water. When the wave comes up here, then disappears, appears up somewhere else. And when we observe this system, we sort of freeze it into a particular state, which is determined in part by the observations we choose to make. So that if I choose to observe particles, I build an apparatus to observe particles, what I will do will be observe these things as particles. But they become particles only because that's what I chose to do. Had I chose to have an apparatus to detect waves, I would have found them as waves. In other words, what happens between our actual observations will not fit into either a local or a disseminated property. And remember, many of the things we talk about in physics are really metaphysics. Light, for example. We talk as though we observe light, but we never observe light. All we ever observe is the interaction of light with matter, either during the emission or the absorption by my eye or a photographic plate or something. Because how could I observe light? Only by sticking something in there in order to detect it. And when I do that, what I'm observing is the interaction of light with matter. And when you start to examine the properties of these things that you have to assume, they will not fit into any of the standard categories. And for that reason, we are desperately in need of a new metaphor. One last property I should have mentioned of the quantum world is that the quantum world, every event is related to every other event in the universe. Do you see echoes? Do you detect echoes of the old medieval worldview? Yes, I think you do. And there's a very serious question in the 20th century, going into the 21st, that we shall probably in science, in one way or another, have to return to a new way, which will not be the same as the old medieval worldview, but which will accommodate aspects of the unity of nature. This has been around in science since around 1930 with Whitehead. It's very difficult to do it because our mathematics is not quite suited. But let me just finish, if I may have 5 minutes more, let me just finish with my own personal ideas of the direction to look. There is a metaphor for nature which is the oldest metaphor for nature that we know, and that is music. And music has this very interesting property, you see, that in a way it is not located. You can't sort of talk about middle C being in a particular point in the concert hall. And yet, in certain sense also, it's a physical structure, the motions of the air. So I would suggest that what's going to happen is that we're going to look to music as the metaphor in the 21st century. And it's not entirely new. Johannes Kepler, that represents stars, that's Einstein. There we are. There's Kepler's representation in music of the motions of the planets. It's a transcription of their dynamical motion into music. It seems a little strange to us in the 20th century, but it came quite natural to Kepler. Even the use of the musical notation implies that time is a sort of spatial dimension. Anyway, what is very interesting is that if you transcribe the music of the actual planets, if you transcribe the motion of the planets in this way, and you play it, the music is harmonious. And not only for the patterns of planets. About 5 years ago, we celebrated, I forget whether it's the 300th anniversary, I suppose, of Kepler's death or something. A German composer whose name, second name escapes me, Gunther is his first name, I've got his record in here, Anyway, it doesn't matter. He wrote a transcription of the motions of the satellites of Jupiter along a similar pattern. The music is harmonious. We have, in other words, in the system of planets, this represents the planetary system, we have a harmonious structure. If we're interested in why the planets are where they are, what is the pattern of planets, we should be looking at a theory that accommodates the disseminated aspects of nature. And so when we take the actual distribution of the planets as we find them, the music's harmonious. And what's interesting is there are some aspects of this harmony whose explanation we still don't know in terms of the ordinary particle physics of Newton. In other words, if we had taken the solar system and said, let me think of the solar system as a drum, vibrating like a drum, we would have got some answers that we haven't yet got by the conventional way of thinking of the solar system made up of particles. This is a long-standing interest of mine. I can remember as an undergraduate student being introduced, for example, to the equations that determine the behavior inside an atom, where the electron is inside an atom. And I remember saying to myself, I saw those equations last year when we were dealing with a guitar string. Not exactly the same, but the same family of equations. In other words, you can get the answer for where the what's going on inside an atom by thinking of an atom as though it were a little drum, as though it were a vibrating system like a guitar string. And it doesn't finish with atoms and with the solar system. I think we're coming towards the end here, yes? Well, I think we might try and focus that. Well, the focus doesn't seem to work, so we'll have to hope for the best without it. That's a photograph taken of the... Could you focus it slightly? I don't seem to be able to focus it here. I don't know if anybody there at the back to... There we are. Oh. Well, it's not a very good slide, maybe. Okay. This is a photograph of the southern sky taken with a wide-angle camera. And there's the Milky Way, which Galileo detected with his telescope, was made up of lots of faint stars. The Sun is one star among about 100,000 million that form a system that we call our galaxy, and galaxy is just the Greek for Milky Way. There's a photograph, that's a dead fly, don't worry about that. There's a photograph of another such system, which we see out in space, another system of 100,000 million stars or so, that we call another galaxy. And within the range of the large telescopes on the Earth, several hundred million galaxies like that are observable. You can go home and use your computer to calculate how many stars there are. All right. But when we look at such structures, this is, for example, a map of our own galaxy, and you see this interesting spiral structure. Here is a photograph of, oh dear, can we do something about that? Can we get that focused? This is a really nice picture. Here we go. Thank you. That's actually it's not a photograph taken with a photographic plate. It's taken with a receiver and computer processed. But you see again this spiral pattern. Our understanding of that spiral pattern is also similar, is that if a structure like a galaxy gets disturbed by another passing galaxy, its response, the mathematics we use is the same family as we use to determine how a drum behaves. The response is that we get a spiral pattern. In a way analogous to the fact, if you take a drum and you scatter iron filings on the drum, you know, and the drum oscillates, the iron filings form a pattern of nodes. In other words, there's a very real sense in which we can think of one of these enormous things of 100,000 million suns as though it were a giant drum. And so I'm just throwing this out as the end to say it is very clear by many, many signs that we're on the edge of another one of these paradigm shifts, as they call them, or gestalt switches, switching from the old lady to the young girl or back again. We're on the edge of just such a switch in science. Whether the switch will be in the direction I suggested, which is that music will come into its own as the metaphor for nature, or whether science will go in some other direction, we don't know. What is clear is that the mechanical view of the world, which has been around for about 300 years, a little bit less, has had its fanfare here, and it's time that the trumpet sounded for it on the other side. And I think that's time I finished. Thank you.
We'll continue.
I think, no, it's a good question. Let me put my perspective on this. A lot of my colleagues, I don't mean at UBC particularly, but a lot of my colleagues would want me to go around talking against astrology. They say that astrology is a pseudoscience, that it does an enormous lot of damage to people's psychologies and things, and that I should always take every opportunity of denigrating astrology. Well, I don't do that, and let me tell you why I don't. In the first place, it seems to me their arguments are a little specious, because I would have thought that far more damage had been done by prostituting physical science. That if I'm going to go and talk about anything, I would talk about prostituting physics by making nuclear bombs. It's a matter of personal history. I don't know whether it interests you, but I find people sometimes are interested. During the war, when I was at university during the Second World War, which dates me pretty well, and whatever my interests were, and I had a lot of interests then. I was interested in art as well as biology and astronomy and things. But I did physics because you really had to do this, and if the war had been on, I would have been out on a radar site or something. I consider it fortunate for the Allies that the war ended, because I'm such a so terribly ham-fisted with mechanical devices that I'm sure we'd have lost the war if they'd ever let me loose on a radar site. But anyway, the war ended in time, and then I had a kind of choice of career, and I decided not to do physics because of the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I want to make my idea quite clear, because people think that's a moral decision, and it wasn't. To me, it was an aesthetic decision. The difference being that, having lived through the war, and rightly or wrongly, you can't avoid imbibing the propaganda, which may sometimes be true, propaganda isn't necessarily false, which was that the war was being fought by the Allies for moral reasons. I wasn't willing to say that it was immoral to have dropped the atomic bomb, but I didn't want to be involved in the possibility of making more powerful weapons. It would have made me uncomfortable. So that's the stance from which I'm coming, that don't argue about having to tell people what to think about astrology. Astrology's done far less damage to anybody than making nuclear weapons has. You must also remember that what goes by the name of astrology now was invented by a journalist of the Daily Express in 1918 as a way of selling the newspapers after the war had finished. It has very little connection with traditional astrology, which after all was not largely concerned with, although it was to some extent, was not primarily concerned with the future of individual people. The sort of classical astrological argument would be that the king would go to his astrologer and say, if I go to battle on Wednesday, will I be in harmony with the universe or out of harmony? There's nothing to stop him being foolhardy enough to go to battle on Tuesday. The astrologer says it's an inpropitious day. There's no